There are few places on earth like a college campus. Different generations, all walks of life, from around the country.
I grew up in LA, but I've always wanted to be a Sooner.
And the world.
I lived in Panama, and now I'm at OU studying creative media production.
Living on campus together, broadening our horizons.
There are ways to think about this that I never thought about before.
Learning, growing, making mistakes.
When it started hailing during our study, I knew that we had miscalculated.
And achieving remarkable things.
I got to help with cancer research, and I'm only an undergrad.
I'm Emily Tackett, and this is Just So, an OU podcast about thought leaders here in the heartland. There's a world of voices on this campus, but there's only one Oklahoma. Today is October 9th, the day that was formerly Columbus Day, but is now Indigenous Peoples Day in 47 cities, 3 states, and 3 universities. Indigenous Peoples Day reimagines Columbus Day, changing a celebration of colonialism into an opportunity to advocate against current injustices and recognize the gravity of genocide and oppression of Indigenous peoples. Out of the 47 cities observing Indigenous Peoples Day, Norman is one of them. So today on the show, we're very lucky to have Dr. Heather Shawn with us to discuss the Native students' experience in higher education, the reclaiming of Native research methodologies, and the movement to reimagine Columbus Day as Indigenous Peoples Day. Super excited to have you today. And to start off, could you just introduce yourself and say what you do at the University of Oklahoma?
Sure. My name is Dr. Heather Shawton. I am a citizen of the Wichita-affiliated tribes. I'm also a Kiowa and Cheyenne descendant. And I'm an associate professor in Native American Studies here at the University of Oklahoma.
Can you talk a little bit about your research on Native American instruction in higher education?
So a lot of my research deals with Indigenous higher education. I look at Indigenous students, issues of success, issues of access, and how our communities are creating pathways to higher education. I also research with Indigenous women. And so looking particularly at how Indigenous women scholars experience higher education, how they encounter the academy, what are their experiences as Indigenous scholars in academia, and just what is that like to be an Indigenous woman scholar in institution of higher ed? So most of my research focuses on two areas. First is Indigenous higher education. So looking at particularly Indigenous students in higher education, what their experiences are, success, aspects of indigenizing higher education, access to higher education for Indigenous students, and how our communities are creating pathways to higher ed. And then also the other area is I do research with Indigenous women, particularly around Indigenous women scholars and what their experiences are in academia and Indigenous women in leadership.
What are those experiences?
They're varied. So my current research project is a photo voice study with 15 Indigenous women from across the United States who are all in academia. So anywhere from doctoral students to assistant professors, associate professors, full professors. And so what they've done is they have taken cameras and they photograph what represents their experience. So what is it like through their eyes to be in academia and to be an Indigenous woman scholar? And the impetus behind that was really about honoring the power of Indigenous women to tell their own stories. And so much of photography has been used to document how other people see us and really been used as a way to silence or erase Indigenous people in general, but particularly Indigenous women. And so when we think about historically how histories of Native people are told from colonizer perspectives, and they exclude the voices and erase the experiences of Indigenous women. And in higher education, Indigenous women are represented at a higher rate than Indigenous men. So it's about a 60-40% split, but not much is written about what our experiences are. And so wanting to combine this desire to honor the narratives and voices of Indigenous women who are in the academy, but also finding a way to have them do that in a creative way and offer a visual narrative and use photography in a different approach than how it's been used against us and how education has been used as a weapon to colonize Indigenous people historically, and how they are are in that space, but reclaiming spaces for their communities, for themselves, and working to indigenize those spaces through their work and their presence in academia.
Can you talk a little bit about colonization of higher education and kind of how that started and where we're at with that today and how it's better or different?
Right. So when we look at the very first universities in what is now the United States, even before we were the United States, those first universities, Harvard and Dartmouth, William and Mary, those colonial colleges, as a part of their mission, actually had the mission to educate Indian youth. Is actually stated in their founding missions. Now, that had a lot to do with how they were receiving funding, because that was a part of the process of quote-unquote civilizing Native people. So the idea was, if you educate, if you Christianize, then and you change Native people, then it made it easier to settle here in what is now America. And so that's how higher education was initially used with Native populations, particularly Native, young Native men. And we've seen over the years, education has been used as a way to continue to colonize, whether it be through federal boarding schools, through mission schools, to change or kind of indoctrinate Native youth so that they became more like Europeans. What we have seen, though, starting around the late 60s, was this reclaiming of education from tribes and for Native people. So we saw this movement towards self-determination and really reclaiming rights of sovereignty as it relates to education through the development of tribal colleges. We've seen a shift where tribes have started to take control back of education. We've also seen in other mainstream or predominantly white institutions that are still built on foundations of Western knowledge and that privileges Western knowledge, we've seen some shifts in some institutions that have done a really great job of acknowledging that every institution in the United States resides on Indigenous land. And so we've seen some shifts, probably not as quickly as we like at all institutions, but other things where we see the development of Indigenous or Native Studies departments and how that creates space for Indigenous knowledge and not just privileging one particular perspective or set of Western knowledge.
So you have a book coming out this fall, right?
Yes. The first one, well, I have one in the fall and one in the spring. They're both edited volumes. The first is with Dr. Robin Minthorn, who's a professor of educational leadership and policy studies and Native American studies at the University of New Mexico. And that's entitled Reclaiming Indigenous Research in Higher Education.
And that talks about the research methodologies that you're talking about earlier, reclaiming those. Can you talk about what those are, kind of, and what that highlights?
What we noticed is that, one, there is limited research, particularly around higher education, that addresses Native people, Native students, Indigenous populations, that's been published. But we also knew that people were actually conducting this research. We know because there are colleagues, there are students, we see the research that they're producing and how important it is for our communities. And so we wanted to acknowledge that research. We also know that there's been this movement for an indigenous methodologies and indigenous research paradigm or decolonizing methodologies that starts in the 90s with Linda Tuhiwai-Smith, who's a Maori scholar, who really kind of begins that conversation about decolonizing methodologies. And then in more recent years, works by Sean Wilson and Margaret Kovach, who have begun to address indigenous methodologies and indigenous research paradigm. Other scholars like Eve Tuck and all indigenous scholars who are doing this work. So we knew that there was this critical work that was happening around indigenous methodologies that not only privilege indigenous knowledge, but are centered on indigenous knowledge, particularly around relationships and how indigenous people understand the world and how we would approach research from an indigenous perspective.
Can you give an example of what those research methodologies are in some of that research that you're highlighting?
Right. So I think one of the easier example is Dr. Amanda Ticini, who's a postdoctor, doctoral fellow at Arizona State University. Her research examined first-year experiences of Navajo students. And her approach to that and to framing that research was to use the concept of Navajo rug weaving. And so she used a story rug approach, is what she called it. And so she likened each part of that research to a step in how a Navajo woman is taught to weave a rug. So each step throughout that, and it was how she conceptualized that research, how she approached it, how she collected the data, how she analyzed it, how she presented it, all within this concept of a Navajo rug. And so she actually calls it a weaving a story rug. And that's so using those stories of the students that were part of that study to weave a story rug of what their experiences are.
That's incredible.
It's really amazing work. And look out for her. She's definitely a up-and-coming scholar and just really amazing. Another example would be Dr. Punihei Laip, who is a Native Hawaiian, and her approach to thinking about place and land and how that relates to universities and situating how we think about that in terms of that all universities sit on Indigenous land, and how we connect our understanding of place and land to our research and our responsibilities to research and communities. And so she does a really beautiful job of how she discusses that too. So there are great examples, those are the ones that come to the just come to the top of my mind, but really great examples.
You can't tell anymore because you have to get the book to get the rest.
Yes, you do.
Can you talk a little bit about representation of Indigenous students in universities?
I think one of the most common statistics is that Native students are one of the least represented populations in higher education, generally make up between 0.8 and 1% of the total student population throughout the nation. And that percentage gets lower the higher we go. So when we get to the graduate level, we're talking 0.5, 0.6%. And then when we talk about faculty, the number of Native faculty in institutions of higher education, we're talking again about a fraction of a percent, 0.5, 0.4% generally. And so we are the least represented population. Now, there are institutions that have high Native student populations, obviously in Oklahoma. We have institutions that have population of 10% or more of Native students. And these are what would be considered predominantly white or mainstream institutions, not tribal colleges, obviously. And so in terms of numbers, there tends to be lower representation. But then, you know, we have to think about representation in terms of what is our representation in the curriculum. What is representation in the very aesthetic of the university? So if we look at a university and look around and look at who's represented in brochures or in advertisements of the university, who's represented in the artwork at a university? If Native people are represented, is it contemporary or is it in a kind of historical sense, as remnants of the past? Are Native people represented in leadership in the student body, in the makeup of policies? So when we talk about representation, that goes to so many different levels, but from a statistics level, because we tend to be one of the least represented, that also means that representation in all of these other areas gets overlooked as well. And so it can be very problematic, particularly for institutions that are in states where there are tribes or that sit on tribal land or where tribes are in close proximity. It's really important that institutions actually have strong relationships with those tribal communities.
How and why are institutions leaving Indigenous students out when it comes to research and projects that purport to address diversity in higher education?
That's a really great question. I think that it comes down to an issue of general invisibility. So we were just talking about the movie Wind River earlier before we started. But when we generally think about like mainstream media, you think about movies and the last time you actually watched a movie that had a Native person, an Indigenous person represented in a contemporary context, you would be hard-pressed to really think of a movie beyond Smoke Signals in the 90s, right? That's everyone's kind of point of reference. When you turn on the television, How often do you see Native people represented on the news, in sitcoms, when you read a magazine or pick up a book? How often are Native people represented? When you think about your own school experience, how much were Native people a part of what you learned about when you were in history? Beyond Oklahoma history, if you were from Oklahoma, or beyond the Trail of Tears or a certain point in history, students aren't generally taught about Native people. Native people aren't included in the larger part of the curriculum. And so it really kind of relegates Indigenous people to a perspective of existing in history or in the past, and not as very real, complex, contemporary people. And so that invisibility really does help to perpetuate the exclusion of Native people from research, from statistics, from curriculum, from policy, because when people are developing these policies or curriculum, we are not at the forefront of their minds because of this continued issue with invisibility.
Because of all of that, what obstacles do underserved students face in higher education?
Yeah, I think it's some of the similar obstacles that other students face. You know, obviously, obstacles of financial aid, obstacles of anything that your general student might encounter. But then when you couple that with issues of invisibility, where you're not seen, you don't see yourself reflected in the institution. You don't see yourself reflected in higher education, meaning if I go into a classroom, chances are I'm not going to have a Native professor unless I'm in very specific classes. Or if I'm in an institution that has a very low Native student population, doesn't have really any Native faculty or identifiable Native faculty, then I'm not going to see myself represented in that professor who's standing at the front of the classroom. I don't see myself represented in the topics that we're discussing or what we might be reading. Am I reading Native authors or research that pertains to Native people? So that can be really problematic because it comes down to, one, having role models or not having role models, seeing yourself reflected in the institution, having curriculum that's relevant to your goals and how you might utilize that for your community. Then there are those obstacles of racism, and Native students who have to encounter hostile campus environments. And that's an ongoing issue for many Native students. And that can be presented in multiple ways, from parties that perpetuate stereotypes and cultural appropriation to mascots, to a university choosing to celebrate Columbus Day versus Indigenous Peoples Day.
I don't know if I told you this, but I actually want to post this podcast on Indigenous People Day, October 9th.
Awesome.
And so I was wondering if you could speak to kind of the movement to replace Columbus Day with Indigenous People Day.
Right. So why we celebrate Columbus Day in the United States, I've never really understood. If we started a very basic starting point of that Columbus actually never set foot in America that we know, like the United States, he didn't discover anything. Also that he didn't discover any land because there were already Indigenous people living and residing in those areas. But also because I've never really been able to understand why the celebration of someone who, when you really look at the history of what he did, was the genocide, murder, slavery that he perpetuated and inflicted on Indigenous populations are not really something to be celebrated. And so it really doesn't make sense. And so I think this movement to Indigenous Peoples Day acknowledges and challenges that narrative that someone else discovered America, when actually Indigenous people were here and had existed in this place for thousands of years. So really pushing back and challenging that narrative that no one existed here before it was quote unquote discovered. So it's about honoring Indigenous people, our place here, our histories here, and acknowledging who we are and honoring that.
How can all of us on campus around the country honor Indigenous Peoples Day?
I think one, just by acknowledging it, I think also pushing for our cities and towns to move away from Columbus Day and towards in celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day. There are many towns in Oklahoma that have started to do that, but there are also major cities that have not. And so taking an active role in pushing for that, not just Oklahoma, but all over the United States, we've had major cities that have moved to celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day, but many have not. So I think pushing for that, honoring that, acknowledging that, and challenging that myth of discovery, challenging that the narrative that has been perpetuated about Columbus that is really not true, and that challenging that narrative by acknowledging the true history of what his actions represented, what he did, and the pain and genocide that were inflicted as a result of his actions. And
right.
So I think those are ways more than anything that people can acknowledge and help to celebrate that.
We can all honor Indigenous Peoples Day by advocating for its observance nationwide and educating ourselves on the history of Indigenous peoples in the Americas. We can stand in solidarity with Native people by recognizing their contributions and take part in national healing with a moment of silence to honor those who died under the doctrine of discovery ideology.
I'm just really fortunate that I've been able to work alongside some really great Indigenous scholars and get to do that work. So it's truly a blessing.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking to us today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. Just So is produced by me, Emily Tackett, and Drew Bernard. Artwork by Amy Azier, and other help from the OU Web Communications team. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. We'll have our fresh episode next week on Just So. See you then.